This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the musician who brought the vibraphone into jazz and became one of the world's best-known band leaders, Lionel Hampton. That's Hampton's 1942 recording of his theme, Flying Home. The record foreshadows the development of rhythm and blues. Before Hampton formed his own band, he played with the Benny Goodman Quartet. The Quartet's records are still considered some of the finest small group sessions in jazz history. The Quartet also made history as the first integrated group. The 81-year-old Hampton still has a big band and tours America and Europe. He also has a new autobiography that tells the story of how he became a drummer, vibraphonist, bandleader, housing magnate, and Republican fundraiser. The book is called Hamp. When Lionel Hampton was a child, he moved with his family from Birmingham, Alabama, up to Chicago.
My grandmother had the family, and she had my uncle, her son, to go to Chicago to find a place where our family could live, because she was taking us up on the pension that my grandfather had left, because he was a fireman on the railroad, and he got a good pension. And we also had tickets that we could travel on the railroad through his pension. And so my uncle went to Chicago, and he stayed a little long time, and my grandmother finally heard from him, and they found out that he had got an apartment, and he had a good job, and he had sent some money along with the money we had, because he was working for Al Capone in his syndicate, in the whiskey syndicate, making bootleg whiskey.
Well, you said that Al Capone was the savior of black musicians.
Yeah, he was. Any place that he controlled, he owned, or any of his associates owned, he would insist that they would hire black musicians. And Earl Hines and Louis Armstrong and Jimmy Noon and several others that I haven't called their names yet, they used to work in these places. And they fed their families, and their pursuit of happiness and living was dependent on these jobs. And we all thank Mr. Capone today that our family was able to survive from the work that he gave us in his place's establishment.
Where did you live when you first moved to Chicago during Prohibition? Were you living near the stills that your Uncle Richard had?
Yeah, we're living in the next building, yes. Because they gave him the building, you know. Oh, the beautiful flat building, you understand?
Capone gave him the building?
Yes. The syndicate, where it was. And then the next door, he owned that building, too. And that's where the family lived at, you understand? And we had a really good living. We was good livers in that times, because we had money enough to have the necessary things that we needed, you know, clothes and food and things like that.
Well, in fact, it sounds like you were pretty well-to-do at the time. You described the silk shirts that you used to wear to school, and a lot of the other students in the school were pretty poor and belonged to gangs and had knives and were very tough, and you didn't feel really up for that.
No. Well, I did. I tell you, my uncle, he and I was very close together, and when he would buy a silk shirt, he would get one to fit me. And when he'd get a hard shopping and marked suit, he would get one to fit me. So I was his buddy, and I ran with him, and I admired him, too.
So you were exposed to a lot of great musicians at the speakeasies. Were you exposed to much of the crime part of the syndicate?
No, just only the good time part, you know.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle used to have, in Chicago those days, he used to have the Blue Monday parties. And that Blue Monday party is when they all used to get together, all the good timers, and they would have different piano players to come in and play for them, which Jerry Roll Moden, I heard him play at a young age, because he came to my uncle's house and played the piano, And he had some wonderful musicians, you know, at that time. A boy by the name of Teddy Rutherford. He was a great piano player. And they had some piano players by the name of Toothpick. Long, tall guy. Boy, he really could play the blues on the piano. And they had another guy that could play by the name of Rabbit. He could play the blues, you understand? And the guys that my uncle picked out to play, well, he would pay them, too. They wouldn't have to come. They get all the whiskey they want to drink, but they would get an honorarium, too.
What was it like when Prohibition ended?
Well, I was in music then. My aunt had moved to California, and my grandmother gave me permission to go out there with her because I had been promised a job with a group called Reb Spikes, and I forgot what Reb called his group. His Rebels or something like that. Because Les Hike, a guy that I had played with around Chicago, when I was playing in Chicago Defender Newspaper Boys Band, I was a youngster, but older musicians liked to play with me because I could keep good time on drums. I really could had a solid beat. So Les Hike moved to California, and he got this job in the Les Hike and Rev Spikes Band, and they needed a drummer, and he told them about me. And boy, I went out there and played and from there I went to the Paul Howard Quality Serenaders. These are the name of these bands in those days, but this was supposed to be the elite band of that area.
Well, I'll tell you, I want to play something you recorded with Paul Howard's Quality Serenaders, but I'm going to go right to a part where you're doing some scat singing, because I especially like your singing on this. This was recorded in 1929. At the time, you were playing drums, a little bit of piano with the band, and doing some singing. This is Lionel Hampton. My guest Lionel Hampton is recorded in 1929. That's just terrific. I love it. It's very funny in your book. You describe how you were imitating Armstrong at the time and how you try almost to get laryngitis to sound more like him.
Well, you know, that Louis was my idol, I guess, as was all the youngsters in that area. Louis was our mentor by way of hearing about on the records, you understand?
You were actually with Louis Armstrong the first time you played the vibraphone.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you first see a vibraphone, and how did you start playing it?
Right in the studio that day that I was with Louis Armstrong. That's the first time I saw the vibe.
So you were recording together. This was in 1930.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what made you go up to it and actually start playing it?
Because he asked me what the instrument was, and I told him, I said, I heard about this instrument. So Louis asked me, he said, what is an instrument? And I was playing it to him. He said, can you play it? And I'm a brazen young kid. I never played it before. I said, sure, because I had played xylophones in Chicago when I was in Chicago in the Fender Band, Newspaper Boys Band. And in the concert band, I played the xylophones and the timpanis. And the marching band, I played the snare drum. So I haven't some of the solos that I was to hear, practice some of the solos that I was to hear Louis Armstrong play on recordings, and also Coleman Hawkins and different good jazz musicians like that. And so Louis asked me to play some on him, on the vibes, and I pull them out in the middle of the floor. In fact, about it, he said, pull them out in the middle of the floor here and play some. And I played one of his solos, note for note, that I'd taken off the record. And boy, he was so enthused. He said, come on, play on the record here. We're going to record. And the number we was going to record was a number that Hubie Blake had just wrote. And he called Memories of You. And Louis was going to record it. And so I played all through Memories of You. And that's the first time jazz ever been played on the vibraphone.
So it was through Armstrong that you, it was when you were with Armstrong that you first started playing vibraphone.
Mm-hmm. I played with Louis for 9 months, and I didn't have no vibes, but I had a little set of orchestra bells that had the same keyboard, and Louis used to have me to play behind him when he sang. I would do the fill-ins. And then I met my late wife, Gladys, and she helped me to get a set of vibes, so she liked the vibes, you know what I'm saying? She was telling me, say, you play drums all right, but play those vibes.
And you knew that you wanted to give up drums for this instrument?
No, I didn't want to give up drums. I wanted to play drums, too, which I do now. I play a lot of drums in my band now. I play drums and vibes and play piano, too.
So when you were playing vibraphones, the first jazz musician to play vibraphones, were musicians anxious or reluctant to play with a vibist?
Well, they was all anxious to play the vibes, but the vibes cost so much money they had to save up the money to get the vibes, and the vibes cost $1,000, $1,500, $2,000, mm-hmm. like that. But they liked the sound. The sound was a sound of electronics, which we have today. So many.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is jazz vibraphonist and band leader Lionel Hampton, who's just written a new autobiography called Hamp. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Lionel Hampton is my guest. It was in the mid-1930s that John Hammond heard you play vibraphones and told Benny Goodman that he should come and hear you. So he came and heard you. I think you jammed. And then he invited you to come back east and join the band. Now, you thought he was inviting you to join his orchestra. But in fact, he was inviting you to join his smaller group, which when you joined became a quartet. Why did he want you in the small group but not in the orchestra?
This place I was playing at the Paradise Nightclub, and I had my band down there playing. Well, lo and behold, Benny Goodman came to California with his orchestra playing at a place called Palomar Ballroom, and John Hammond had been in my place, heard me play and brought Benny down, and lo and behold, I was playing one night, and there I heard this guy playing clarinet next to me, and I said, gee, this is great. And it was Benny Goodman. He had brought Gene Krupa with him and brought Teddy Wilson. Teddy Wilson used to go with Benny at that time, but he would play intermission piano. He wasn't playing with the band. And it was uncalled for that black and white mixed together in those days. They didn't. In fact, about blacks and whites, socially economically, didn't gel together in those days. And so Benny got on the stand and played with me, and he liked it so well, we jammed for about 2 hours. So he said, come on, let's record this out the RCA studio. And we did. We went out there, and we made a record. And the record got so popular. We made Moon Glow and Dinah. It got so popular, and it could run all awards all over the country. And everybody started to saying, well, this is great. This is a new find here. And so that's the reason why Benny wanted me to come, and he wanted to keep the quartet going, because the quartet had achieved a high point in the music business that I didn't think Benny was looking for. And then there was a chance to mix to have white and black play together. I don't think Benny was looking at that so much, but he realized later that he was being Abraham Lincoln for the music business.
Mm-hmm. Let me play something that you recorded with Benny Goodman as part of the Benny Goodman Quartet. And this is Sweet Georgia Brown, as recorded in 1938.
Thank you.
my guest Lionel Hampton, featured on Vibes. This Benny Goodman Quartet with you and Teddy Wilson at the piano, it's the group that broke the color barrier in jazz. And you said that there was actually fear that there'd be race riots when you first started performing. Did anything like that ever happen? What was the most negative response you got when the quartet started playing?
Well, I'll tell you, we played in Dallas, Texas, and they had the big centennial down there at the big bowl. And they had a lot of attractions that come there to try to fill the place, and none of them could. So somebody told them, said, we ought to get Benny Goodman's group. So Benny told them what he had, two black boys playing in his organization. And they said, well, okay, come on. And they went down and played. They played for 10 days. It was a place held about 20,000 people. And Benny kept the place packed every night and probably that many was outside waiting to get in. But on the fairground, they had white drinking water and black drinking water. So Teddy and I, you know, we was from the north, and we didn't pay much attention to where we should drink the water. So we used to drink out of white drinking water. And so policemen reprimanded us about doing this. And so Teddy didn't want to play down there no more. So Benny finally got the chief of police and some of the leaders of the town telling him that there wasn't nothing going to happen, that we was respectable guys, respectable gentlemen, and that wasn't nobody going to bother us, and that we could drink out any water we wanted. And that's the only thing that ever happened.
You left the Goodman Quartet in 1940, mm-hmm. and formed your own orchestra.
Yeah.
You say in your book that you've always wanted to carry on the tradition of showmanship and clowning in black performing. Why has that been important to you?
Well, clowning, I never was clowning. The music moved me, and if I feel like I want to dance, I feel like I want to jump up and shout, well, I do it. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were the first one that used to go out in the audience and do the tailgate parade, you know, and involve the audience and do what I was playing. And but we didn't do it just because we had something fixed, you know, to do some clowning like that. It was only spiritual. The spirit hit us and we moved.
When you were leading your own band and touring the country, when there was still segregation and you were performing in the South, was it different for you? Did you end up staying in different places? And what was it like to be leading a band in the segregated South then?
Yeah, well, it didn't happen that long. It happened about one time around. It, you know, I had a mixed band. I took the first mixed band in the South. And the people just hoorayed for it. I mean, the whites used to have to be up in the balcony, and they would come down from the balcony and come down the main floor and mingle with the blacks, you understand? In some places they have ropes in the middle of the dance hall, and they would have whites on one side and blacks on the other side, and somebody would cut the rope, and everybody would mix together again. And you understand, the people just cheered, I mean, black and whites alike, and we had no trouble at all.
While your wife, Gladys, was alive, she served as your business manager.
Mm-hmm.
And you describe how she would always tell producers to not give the money to you, but to give it to her.
Yes.
What was your problem with money?
No, that was the best thing in life I ever did, because she invested and put it in the right place. And when she passed on, she told me, said, you be able to look in some of the literature or the books or look in the wills, and you'll find out that you'll be protected for life.
What was your problem with money? Why did she take it and not let you have it? She'd give you an allowance.
Yeah, well, yeah, I like to have a good time. You know, give it away. You know, the guy come and give you a hard luck story. Yeah, here it is, man. Take it, understand? You know, that was my makeup.
Well, she and you had a reputation among musicians, I think, for being a little stingy with money when it came to paying the salaries of the orchestra members. Well, you even say in your book that there was a period during World War II when the band members were getting $38 a night, and Gladys was buying $1,000 war bonds each week.
Well, that was her business, you understand? I knew later that I've seen the benefits of it. Good benefits.
Mm-hmm. You've also in your life been very active in politics.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly for the Republican Party. How did you become politically involved?
Well, I was in Los Angeles, California, and when President Nixon was a congressman in Los Angeles, he was used to come and campaign on amongst the blacks because he knew that he had a good sea of people there that never was in politics before that he can convert them, and he did. You know, out of 22,000 blacks on South Central Avenue, he converted about 12,000 to be Republicans. And I used to go and play with him in his parties and also his rallies. And we got to be good friends. And right up until he got to be vice president, from vice president, he got to be president. We was always connected with each other.
So you helped him register a lot of black voters before the election?
Yeah, in Los Angeles, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's your tour schedule now? You're still very active musically.
Oh, tour. I just been to Europe four times.
Already?
Every time I go four weeks at a time, yeah. And going again in December 27, I opened up at the Meridian Hotel in Paris for 2 weeks.
Do you think you'll ever retire from music?
No. I'm going to stay out there in this place as long as I can. I love it. This is my life. I don't know anything better I like than to play music. And can play. I think I'm right at the top peak now playing.
Okay, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Hi, thank you.
Lionel Hampton has been my guest, and he has a new autobiography, which is called Hamp, and it's published by Warner Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.